This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Clara Bingham. She's the author of Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. It's a great subtitle. It is the year beginning August 1969 through 1970.
Right, about September.
Right, so it's a little more than a year.
Yeah, it's the school year.
Right, and it's kind of the baker's year.
Exactly, exactly.
But this is, you know, really was, I love this book, and I really wanted to talk to you about it because I lived through this period of time, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say I was as involved as a lot of the people that are in the book, but it is, you know, for me, living history, and it's really nice to have this comprehensive talking about what actually was going on, especially some of the people in the book who were so important in that period and sometimes not as well known. I'm curious to know, I mean, you talk about it a little bit in the introduction, but you know, maybe you should talk about what prompted you to spend a lot of your life in this, you know, kind of going back in history and talking to people about 1969, 1970.
Well, I'm still asking myself that question, but I think the way to really sum up what my motivation was to spend really the last 5 years delving into the 60s was a quote of President Obama's in his Audacity of Hope memoir. And he was born in 1961. I was born in 1963. So essentially, I missed it. You know, I was too young to really know what be involved in what was going on in the late 60s. And Obama did too. And so he said, he wrote, "I've always felt a curious relationship to the 60s. In a sense, I'm a pure product of that era."
Right, because you guys grew up in the aftermath, which really, and as the book kind of indicates, it's the cultural impact that has, that people have felt.
It survived.
It talks about the various isms that we still live with today. Some people still don't like it. But, you know, in some ways, when we look back, we did change the world.
Absolutely.
And people who grew up after, and I think I felt this in talking to, I remember talking to people who were, let's say, maybe 20 years after the fact. You were more like 10 years after the fact, kind of as you come of age. And they felt really strongly that they'd missed this wonderful time, you know, that it became kind of mythological.
Right.
For people who followed. Now, different. I mean, because more time has gone by.
Right, right. So there was that sense in this sort of, if you grew up in the 80s,
right,
of having just knowing that just before, you know, just when you were a young kid, so much was going on. And so you could just touch it. And for me, I call it the wallpaper of my childhood. You know, I grew up on the Upper West Side, and the Central Park was my playground, and it was the staging ground for the movement. And so much was going on. Every, you know, women's rights protest and environmental protest and, of course, anti-war protest was going on in Central Park and all over the city. And, you know, the Panther 21 trial was going on when I was about 9. And so these things were, and of course, the war was very much in the news, but I was just a little too young to be involved in it. But of course, it completely shaped who I am as a person. So there's a sense of knowing that, you know, I'm not the same person because of what happened in the 60s.
Right.
And but I didn't engage in it.
So it was kind of, I mean, you didn't do this kind of as a, you did do it as an act of history recording, but it's motivated in a lot of ways by personal.
Yeah, it's motivated by a really powerful curiosity. And because I missed it, I wanted to know what I missed.
So and did you have older siblings?
No, I didn't. But I had a aunt who I call in the acknowledgments the godmother of the book. And her name is Eleanor, and she's 15 years younger than my father. There were 5 children in that generation. So she, you know, he was a classic class of 54, you know, college graduate, 50s guy. And she was a very serious first generation boomer hippie. and she was the videographer for the Grateful Dead, and she was very close to Bear Owsley, their sound man and the great acid manufacturer, and Abby Hoffman, and she lived in London, and she just had a very exotic life in the 60s and early 70s, and I adored her. And she also has a kind of very free-spirited, big-hearted spirit that I've always been very attracted to. And so I knew that she led this life that was very wild, and she for a while was a black sheep of the family, and she was cut off, and everyone was very concerned about her. But of course, I thought she was a romantic character who really lived her life to the fullest in a lot of ways. And I, of course, went to college in the 80s during Reagan and graduated in 1985, just exactly 15 years after the greatest student strike in America, when we had came as close as we had ever come to a civil war since the 1860s. So by the time I graduated, by the time Eleanor was then settled down and having kids and living in Kentucky on a farm, everything had quieted down. But I was just acutely aware of just so recently so much turmoil had occurred that had completely changed the cultural and partly political landscape of the country. And that I, as a young woman, could participate in any job I wanted, live any sort of lifestyle I wanted to live because of the revolutionaries, essentially, who had come before me. So I really wanted to learn about what had happened then. And I also felt that because I was of an outside generation, I could look at it in a different way because I didn't have, it was a clean slate to me, essentially. I had not been involved in any particular sector of the movement. And I felt that I could therefore try to see it and understand it from an outsider's point of view, which I think in telling history is often important, because I didn't have my own axe to grind. I didn't have my own, preset point of view. And so I felt as if I was, visiting another country, another era. And every time I interviewed each of these people, I interviewed 100 people over the course of about 4 years, and wrote this as an oral history narrative. So it's all in their voices. And
well, except that you frame
it. Except for I frame
you, it. And it is interesting to think about. I mean, when you're writing history, you have to, there is a framework, and sometimes it evolves from the material, and other times it might be imposed on the material. And it's always an interesting issue for, I think, anybody writing nonfiction. But you have the benefit of the structure of the year and the events of the time.
Right.
But still, you chose by the choices you made of who you talk to, you also get a different, everyone will have different views. So you did seek out a certain kind of person.
Yes. I mean, my point of view is very much evident in this book, I assume. And I followed my nose in terms of looking for people who I thought were interesting, who I thought were at the sort of forefront, the vanguard of the movement of for social change. And so... but at the same time, I tried to get as much diversity as I could. And also, I felt like so many books about the 60s are about different parts of the 60s, because it was such a rich time, and there were so many movements. There was the psychedelic movement and the counterculture. There was the civil rights and Black Power movement. There was the anti-war movement. And what happened by the very end of the 60s is these three movements came together and created a, incredibly tumultuous, almost perfect storm of change and rebellion. And so I wanted to find people in all of those movements so that the reader could get a sense of what it was really like, on the streets during that time, to live during that time. And so so I found members of the Black Panther movement. I found members of SDS and the Weathermen. I talked to musicians and acid manufacturers and feminists, and everyone really came in by having the year and having these events of the year, I was able to weave all their stories together in a narrative arc. And interestingly, some of the stories all come together in the end, where you have members of Weather Underground and helping Timothy Leary escape from jail.
I know that was one of the more surreal occurrences that I think, you know, you highlighted it. And I think sometimes it was like, I still sometimes can't wrap my head around that particular congruency. That was a weird thing.
It sure was.
Even then.
It was pretty great, though. And it was a caper.
I made a list of, and I actually left that off, but if you list all, you know, from the book, kind of the big events of that year, it's like stunning. Woodstock, the trial of Chicago 8, My Lai itself, the Pentagon Papers being published for the first time, Altamont, horrible story, Days of Rage, and all of the Weather Underground activities beginning, the invasion of Cambodia, the disaster at Kent State and Jackson State as well. That's an incredible array for 1 year of time. It's just stunning in a lot of ways to think about, you know, how much happened in that period of time. But it shows, I think, how fraught the period was. And it was like, because if you really, you see that 69-70 is the, it's part of the story leading up to that is what happened earlier in the 60s. There are a lot of things going on. So by the time you get to 1969-1970, there's a lot of energy.
I see it as the crescendo, really, of the 60s. And by focusing on people and character, we, of course, have parts of the book that, you know, build up to that year. Because you want to know, why is it that Bernadine Dorn was, you know, head of the Weather Underground? Well, that took, you know, a lot. There was a lot that brought her to the table by 1969. So we follow several characters, David Harris, who was head of the resistance. And what was he doing in the mid 60s? Well, he was actually at Mississippi, involved in, you know, registering black people to vote. And a lot of people were involved in the civil rights movement.
Yeah,
and so,
I think Freedom Summer actually is really important.
Yes.
As a precursor because of all the organizing work that went on there.
Exactly.
And actually, it's, you know, we're sort of just passing through the 50th, you know, we passed through the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary of a lot of these events. We're beginning to, you know, we're kind of richly in the 50-year mark for a lot of things that
right,
were going
on. Right, all those mid-60s events. So, but I saw the year is in a way as a portal through which to look at really the whole decade. And that this is where the decade really came to an end.
Right.
Although
it does end literally the 60s, it's true, but if we think of, you know, the period known as the 60s really kind of more starts in like 63, 64 and goes on through 74, 75, probably the end of the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
That's really the period that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. In fact, most people feel that decades are almost culturally start right in the middle. And of course, the first half of the 60s was culturally the 50s.
Yeah,
and it was,
that's true.
And that but it's fascinating to see how quickly things changed by the very end of the 60s. You know, we went from, you know, don't forget the Beatles had short hair and were wearing suits. You know, don't forget there were parietals in college and girls had to check in at 10 o'clock and were getting kicked out if they were caught in the boys' room. I mean, it was really another world. And then all of a sudden, by 1968, things really flipped.
Yeah,
and I maintain that it was this perfect storm of the civil rights movement coming, you know, boiling up over the course of the month of the decade, and the anti-war movement kicking in by 65 when we started sending troops to Vietnam.
Well,
and
it's
the draft.
Also because there was this thing called the baby boom generation. You have millions
many
of
more
people, more
kids
people
in college,
right? And they're all
affluent,
all lived through this period of you know, kind of repressive culture mm-hmm. and kind of vapidity of television, you know, the Newton Minow, you know, vast wasteland right. that we all grew, we grew up in the vast wasteland, and we were ready for something more colorful than black and white television. And
exactly.
so, but also there is, you know, it's, oh, you can't really figure out, you know, all of this, even talking to 100
no.
people.
No, definitely not. I mean, I really need to talk to, you know, 10,000 people.
Yeah.
But can I just quote this one quote? Was one of my favorite quotes from Robin Morgan, who is a feminist and
she
one
was
of the early.
I was really glad that you talked to her because she was very important to a lot of people.
Yes, she's such a brilliant spokeswoman and writer, and she was a poet and actress, and was involved in the anti-war movement, and then split with many of her female compatriots and started the Women's Lib movement in 1970. And this is how she described that feeling that you just mentioned of all coming out of the 50s and the repression of the 50s. We were a whole generation that for the first time said no to a war that the country had found itself mired in, and then began saying no to other things, and did so awkwardly at times and with bombast and rhetoric and prick waving, but at least was questioning the death grip of the 1950s, which was a stultification of passion and sanity and the genius of the human spirit. And this burst through all of that with day-glow colors like the Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white to color. Everything suddenly was technicolor, and there was hope.
I know. It's true. I mean, a lot of what comes across in the book, I think, is beautiful and joyous. But it's also, you know, you remember the serious stuff that was going on then. And
dark, very dark.
Really. And some bad things, like bad things by the government, including infiltrating and trying to destroy without really having the right to do it, you know, breaking
completely
the law
illegally
to destroy the Black Panther Party mm-hmm. and to destroy the anti-war movement. And, you know, that is a dark period. But at the same time, you also have the darkness and kind of errors, as people will call them, of the other side, you know,
yep.
the
excess
people in the Weather Underground doing stuff that I would say the vast majority of the people who were on their side, I count
you being
myself,
one of them.
Yeah, in that group, disagreed with, and I mean understood what they were doing, but could not accept it. And as they realize now, I think, as you know, as they talk to you. They did a lot of harm. They harmed the movement. And it was kind of self-indulgent, middle-class bourgeois excess, which is pretty bizarre. And then you even highlighted in one point, which I had not even thought about in years, that they were told that the Days of Rage was a bad idea.
By the Panthers.
Right.
And by the Cubans.
Right.
And the North Vietnamese.
All the people who actually knew.
Their kind of lefty advisors.
Right.
And told them it was a bad idea. They were playing right into Nixon's hands.
But it was part of the youthful excess, which is to not listen to anybody who says no to you, including your allies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I mean, other things you can think about that, you know, there that they didn't work with at all. Well, they did, but not, they didn't work successfully with working people. You know, they
yeah.
alienated their natural allies and created this fissure in the society, which still exists.
Yeah.
Between, you know, a blue-collar person and a middle-class person became a culture.
Right. Well, and that was part, you can't blame the Weather Underground on that, because I think that also was the counterculture. That, you know, hippies in general and the lifestyle and the counter,
oh, offended,
you know, was offensive
offended
to working
yes.
class.
But no, I'm talking about the political, but the political movement did not take a long view. It took the immediate,
mm-hmm.
Immediate gratification view. And the other mistake is, I think, in not realizing that if you're going to go up against mainstream culture and the war machine is going to fight back.
Right.
And it has a lot of power, and it has a lot more power than you do. And the naivete is just stunning.
Stunning.
Just beyond
belief.
To think
that you can fight fire with fire,
yeah.
which is essentially what they, what the militant wing of both the Black Power and the anti-war movement decided to do when they were, you know, and understandably, they were tired. It had been an entire decade of conscientious objection, of peaceful protest. And, you know, they could get 500,000 people to Washington, D.C., and it wouldn't change Nixon's point of view at all. It got, they were driven mad, essentially, by the intractability of the Nixon administration. And so they went over the edge. And it was a huge, massive mistake, I think. Yeah.
And you can say now, you know, they were young. They were
they
didn't know better.
They were in their early 20s.
Didn't have anybody to tell them any differently. But doesn't excuse it does not excuse, bombing things and, you know, blowing it, just it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So you have to look back
and
at
it. And it's morally, I mean, it morally, not only does it not work strategically, which it really doesn't do, but, you know, morally, they lost the moral high ground.
Absolutely.
And you know, if you want to be a peace movement,
you have to be
you
nonviolent.
You can't be hypocritical.
No, you have to be nonviolent. And that's the stronger movement is the one that lasts.
Yeah.
And their movement could not last. And the stronger movement that lasts has to be based on moral values and not self-indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as you said, they may have been angry, but that doesn't excuse going that next step.
Right. I mean, I think just for listeners who weren't there, one of the things we can talk about that's an example of going that next step was the townhouse bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And so on March 6th of 1970, they were called the Weathermen at that point, who had split off from SDS. And at that point, SDS, in June of 69—
which is Students for a Democratic Society.
Thank you. Had at least 100,000 members. And that's what they had actually legitimately on the books. But many people were a member without having sent in their card. So there were probably twice that many. And it was the largest student organization. It was the largest anti-war organization. And it had the potential to have a huge amount of power and influence. But unfortunately, it split up in June of 1969 at the convention in Chicago.
Well, and part of the blame for that—
Were you there?
No. But part of the blame for that has to also go to the Progressive Labor Party, which tried
PL
tried to shift SDS into serious Marxism. And, the you know, most of the members of SDS were not serious Marxists. They were student activists. They were radical, but they were not going. They didn't believe in a strict Maoist Marxism.
And they were waving their red books, their Mao book.
And that drove a lot. The two things, the PL and the Weather Underground, I mean, the Weathermen, who later became the Underground, they destroyed SDS.
Right.
And they just did. And it was.
So that would probably be one of the great tragedies of the movement.
It may turn out that in the end, that was done by agent provocateur.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be surprising because that's how the power structure has responded to radical leftist organizing. One way is to get them to do terrible things, which will discredit them and enable the other side essentially to come down on them with moral force because they've done things that are immoral and outlandish.
Right. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar, not Herbert.
Not Herbert. J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI for 48 years under 6 presidents. He essentially had his own secret police. And he had assigned 2,000 FBI agents to go undercover and infiltrate, disrupt, and eliminate. These are his words written in a memo. And eliminate the list of the movements. But initially, it was the Black Panther movement and the anti-war movement. But he then went after the feminist movement, went after the environmental movement, food co-ops. I mean, everything. The counterculture, communes were infiltrated. And the idea was to, you know, disrupt and eliminate. And they did a very, very good job. And we just only have a small idea of how far they went, you know.
Are those records not available?
There, some have been FOIA'd, and there are, you know, there are Freedom of Information Act, and we have, and books have been written about them, but it's still not the full picture. We don't have the full picture on, you know, there haven't been a lot of interviews with the actual agents.
Right, they won't.
About what
you
they did.
You talked to one.
I talked to one. He was one of my favorite interviews, Bill Dyson, who was not part of the secret police. He was a straight agent.
But he knew what was going
on. He knew just what was going on.
Yeah.
He disapproved of it because he realized that nothing that they, no evidence that they gathered was admissible in court.
Right.
And in the end, that actually really hurt the FBI. And you could even say that more FBI agents were indicted. Certainly more FBI agents were indicted than Weather Underground members because of what they did so illegally trying to, you know, gather evidence against the Weather Underground. So it really, by 1976, once Carter came into office, the FBI was in tatters, and partly because of all this illegal behavior.
Right.
And Nixon, you know, and Watergate occurred also partly because of the plumbers. One of the first acts of the White House plumbers was to illegally spy on the, you know, break into Dr. Fielding's office, Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist.
Right. Who Daniel Ellsberg was the guy who published the Pentagon Papers, which he had been a RAND employee, government contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So he had access to all this material that documented the illegal bombing and all of the illegalities of the Vietnam War. So
right.
He had 1,000 pages of basically stolen government documents that he was making public, and
right.
They wanted to discredit him.
Right, and so he was on trial for treason.
Right.
You know, he could have gone to jail for life. And that wasn't good enough, and they wanted to find another way to destroy his character.
Right.
And so one of the first things the plumbers did was go into Fielding's office. And when that was discovered, and also other things were discovered, which during the trial, Ellsberg's trial, which is that they had tapped the phones of Mort Halperin, who was a National Security Council official who was friends with Ellsberg and who they thought maybe had leaked information. And so when those two illegal things were discovered, Ellsberg went free and his trial was dismissed. So the illegal behavior by the government is stunning. Really stunning, and it definitely did provoke the lefties to go too far. And so it was, you know, everyone has to take responsibility for what they did, obviously, and I'm not apologizing for the mistakes of the militant left. But at the same time, one of the big surprises for me writing this book was understanding how really nefarious and evil the FBI was in attacking the movement.
Have you had any kind of pushback on the exposure or positions that?
No, and I don't think I revealed anything that has not been public record before. So I haven't, and no one's been following me, or I don't think my phone's been tapped either.
Well, there are still, I mean. The political people are still controversial, kind of politically.
Well, yeah, I mean, still Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn are very, very controversial, and they have been used, you know, against President Obama.
Right, because Bill Ayers taught at the University of Chicago,
and they were on the board of a community organization together.
Right,
and you know, the fact is that Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn have been very good citizens for the last 40 years, and Bill Ayers has published 13 books on education and been a professor in education, incredibly successful.
But there are some people who will not forgive.
Right.
And in fact, there are people who still hold Jane Fonda as,
big time.
You know, and she says in your book, I thought it was really interesting that she realized that she made a terrible mistake when she was in North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
allowing herself to be used as a propaganda symbol.
Exactly.
And
that
photograph. really, it was a big deal.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's still a big deal. And she has been vilified, absolutely vilified for, you know, as Hanoi Jane, right, for that one photograph of her sitting in front of an anti-aircraft gun.
Well, you know, I've this is my own feeling about this, but I do think that, you know, there's a sort of general feeling among the boomer generation, even, you know, many of those who participated in this, what we call the 60s or 70s or whatever they were, who don't acknowledge what good came of that, because there was so much of a backlash, you know, the Reagan era.
The Vietnam syndrome.
Yeah, it kind of makes you feel like you have something to be embarrassed by, you know, like,
right,
the idea, like hippie, the word hippie now
is
incredibly, it kind of diminishes the meaning. And that's partly because of the excess and the, and, you know, a lot of things that were done and said in popular culture that really distorted the meaning, you know, what hippies were. And you have Peter Coyote in the book, who was an original member of the Diggers, and the Diggers were one of the really founding organizations of what we would call the hippie movement,
right,
in San Francisco. And those were serious ideas that they were trying to promulgate about changing the way we relate to each other, changing the way we relate to materiality and materialism, and trying to change ideas about how people lived. That was actually in some ways more politically subversive. And the hippies, I don't think, have gotten credit. They've become a joke. But and I think for a lot of people who lived through that period, we don't acknowledge enough how important it was. And that's partially because it feels like a lot didn't change structurally. Nothing did change, only culturally.
Mm-hmm.
But the cultural things that changed are actually pretty good. You know, you talked
about long-lasting and important.
Yeah. I mean, food co-ops.
The 60s have been totally misunderstood, I think.
Yeah.
And that it's, and for that reason, that partly it was very much of a strategy of the Reagan administration, the Reagan era, to kind of bring back patriotism,
mm-hmm,
and to shed the Vietnam syndrome, of which is that we lost this war, and we also lost the sort of law and order and conventionality of the 50s. And so that those two things went together as a sense of, and so the right and you know, tried to take back the country, essentially.
Right.
And they did.
Actually succeeded.
And they did. And by doing Jane Fonda, this is something I did not realize until I researched her story and talked to her. She went to Hanoi in 1972. Hundreds of anti-war activists went to Hanoi. It was not a big deal. Everyone went, you know, and rotated in and out. And it was never much of a story. She came back from Hanoi, and it was a two-paragraph piece in the New York Times. The photograph never surfaced until the 1980s. And it was in the 1980s that suddenly that story came out, and she became Hanoi Jane. So it was as if she was being used as a symbol,
yeah,
of everything,
yeah,
that was wrong with the 60s. And you know, all the pro-war vet organizations decided to attack her, and she represented all of the anti-war activists who did not embrace them when they came back from,
right,
the war, and everything that was wrong.
Well, and also history was rewritten, because it was stated that, you know, the peace movement and people spit on the veterans. And, yeah, I mean, there were some people who were pretty nasty to soldiers. But,
yeah,
there were a lot of people in the anti-war movement who embraced the soldiers and saw them as the victims and as their partners in the anti-war movement. And you had,
well, certainly,
you know,
by the end of the 60s, I think earlier in the movement there was much more hostility, but once they started coming back from the war in large numbers, the unintended consequence of that was Vietnamization, which was one of Nixon's plans, was we'll get everyone to stop, you know, taking to the streets, because we'll just start bombing with B-52s and we'll bring the boys home. But the problem is, all of a sudden, they brought home 200,000 boys who were not happy with what they had just experienced in the war. And they, many of them, joined the Vietnam vets against the war. And this became new blood in the movement, and actually the most important part of the anti-war movement by the late 60s were the vets themselves. And there was nothing more powerful than seeing hundreds of vets, many of them in wheelchairs, with their flak jackets, protesting against the war. I mean, and that was, of course, one of the scariest things to the Nixon administration. And they also infiltrated the Nixon administration, the COINTELPRO, infiltrated the Vietnam Vets Against the War, tried to disrupt them, had agents and provocateurs, the whole thing, because they knew they were, very scary.
Yeah, well, that was—
because they had so much moral authority.
Right, they did. And, anybody who has served can say things about what war is that you can't dispute.
Exactly.
If you've never been.
Yeah, I interviewed a wonderful vet, a man named Wayne Smith, who's African American, who described— he was a medic, and he was just incredibly sensitive and articulate about his experience. And when he came home, he landed in Seattle, and then on a military plane, and then switched to fly on a commercial flight to Boston, where he lived. He lived in Providence. And he walked into the men's room in the airport in Seattle, and the trash can was filled to the brim and overflowing with army fatigues. And he could tell that everyone come right off their military plane, gone into the bathroom, and changed out of their clothes. And he said that when he was on the plane, he saw people who were wearing long-haired wigs and sort of newly minted hippie clothes. Who we knew were probably servicemen who were trying to hide that they were in the service.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's incredibly sad and poignant that that's how much— I talked to a lot of people who were involved in trying to expose the war atrocities. And the atrocities that went on in Vietnam were terrible, and so terrible for American soldiers. I mean, the people who were committing the atrocities, in a way, were victim of a unspoken policy, military rule, which is kill anything that moves.
Right.
And we've now learned recently much more about that as more files have been revealed. And Nick Turse wrote an amazing book called Kill Anything That Moves that showed that it was all about body count, and it didn't really matter if they were friend or foe, and in fact it was impossible to tell in the jungle. And so that was why my interview with Cy Hirsch, who wrote about the My Lai story, who was this young investigative reporter, was so fascinating to me, because so many people maintain that My Lai was just— it was a much more extreme example. The American soldiers killed 500 villagers, many of whom were women and children, toddlers, pregnant women. It was a horrific massacre. But there were many My Lais that took place, and that just holding up My Lai as an exception, which is what the military wanted to do, was not correct. That in fact, a lot of soldiers had committed war crimes and had done it really with the a wink and a nod from the brass.
Yeah. Well, it was— they were doing what they were told to do.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So of all the people— I mean, you interviewed 100 people.
I used about 87 in the book. I didn't get to use everybody.
Right. But did you have like a sense of— when you were done with these interviews, like, what stood out? Like, what was the most kind of shocking or surprising, or, is there one thing that you could say is really interesting to you that came out of this that you might not have thought would be your reaction?
I think the conclusion that so many people who I interviewed from all different parts of the movement had— I didn't quite know it when I walked in, which was that the cultural wars won and the political wars lost. And when I started writing this story, I was much more interested in politics. I'm a political reporter. That was sort of my area. And I started interviewing, members of SDS and the Weathermen. And then I went and I thought, I've got to throw in the counterculture. you know, because obviously that had something to do with it. What I didn't realize was how much it had to do with it. I know. I wasn't there, so.
Well, no, in fact,
I think how really important it was.
Right. No, I mean, I think the book does, you do focus on politics, and I don't think you omitted the counterculture, but I do think that there's much more to be told because those stories are more individualized or more communitized, you know, that what happened in Seattle may not have been the same as what happened in St. Louis. And, you know, people who went into the hills of California had a different experience maybe than the people who went back to the land in Maine or
Vermont.
Right. Or, yeah. I mean, there are pockets where. But then there also are just different experiences. You know, the South, you know, the kind of rock and roll hippies of the South were rednecks, a lot of them. You know, they have redneck values mixed in with drug culture and a lot of kind of wildness. You know, there's just really a variety. America's a big place.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we liked about that period, if we were there, was how much people came together across all of these different cultural boundaries, you know, that you could, I mean, actually be fairly nervous going through Wyoming in 1970 if you had long hair, but you would be able to find people who would talk to you, you know, who you could relate to. And that was a really interesting thing. So that the cultural story might require talking to 10,000 people.
Right, I get it.
And I've actually thought about that it would be really interesting to build a website thinking about, although it might end up being really boring because you get a lot of stories about, you know, acid trips and, you know, other stuff.
Leaving.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know how interesting it would be. But the idea that people could, like the oral, you know, the StoryCorps, that you could invite people to tell their stories. Now, I've visited a few websites that attempt to do stuff like that, and as you might suspect, they are really boring because people tell so many of the same stories. But if you could figure out how to, you know, kind of winnow through all of that, I think there is something there, you know, a different form of oral history, maybe, because it wouldn't be narrative in the same way.
Right, no, exactly. It wouldn't be curated.
Right. Or you might have to curate it, but you would not be telling the story the way you did in this book.
Right, right.
Well, you know, we could go on and on, but I'm going to thank you for doing this and, you know, really just thank you for putting this book together and spending the 5 years that you did. I really appreciate it.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thank you for having me. And I'm only regretting that I didn't get to ask you, where were you in 1969 and 70?
Well, we can talk
about
that.
We have another show about that.
That'll be another time. Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Clara Bingham about her really incredible book, Witness to the Revolution, which I really recommend.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Thanks.